I'm Chris Sims, and this is the Canadian Taxpayers Podcast. We're dedicated to lower taxes, less waste, and more accountable government. In this episode, we have a special interview for you. Our Prairie Director, Todd McKay, speaks with Conservative Party leadership candidate, Dr. Leslyn Lewis. One of six children, Dr. Lewis's family immigrated to Canada from Jamaica when she was 5 years old. Lewis earned a PhD from Osgoode Hall Law School with specializations in business and environmental studies. She started her own law firm and practiced for 20 years. She has two children and she lives in Toronto. Todd caught up with Dr. Lewis on the campaign trail to find out why she wants to lead the Conservatives in the next election. Take it away, Todd.
Leslyn Lewis joins us today. She's running for the Conservative Party of Canada leadership. She's a lawyer. She's not just a lawyer. She's got a doctorate in law. And now she'd like to take a shot at becoming prime minister. Dr. Lewis, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Okay, my first question is about the carbon tax. Obviously, the Canadian Taxpayers Federation has opposed the carbon tax. You've come out against the carbon tax. If you become prime minister, how quick will you get rid of it? Will it be before or after lunch on your first day?
Well, to be honest with you, it's something that is in my platform. So I think it's very important to abolish it pretty soon in my reign as the leader. And I believe that it's very important for us to also assess what the situation is and to let the public know what the cost impact will be and what other things that we might have to juggle around in order to deal with this, because we're going to have to find efficiencies in other areas. I think that the government has expanded their spending to account for this carbon tax, even though it was supposed to be aimed at really having sustainable practices and in invoking environmental stewardship. And I don't think that that's what it's done. Unfortunately, the majority of people who are suffering from this are low-income individuals and also farmers. They've seen their entire profits eaten up by this carbon tax. And so it's something that has to be dealt with very expeditiously. And we also have to have a costed impact assessment as to what other areas are going to be affected so that the public knows. And I think that's part of the problem that we've had a government who hasn't done impact assessments on certain legislations and other initiatives.
So just to break that apart a little bit, as leader, you would like to show the cost and benefit, provide more certainty to that argument. But if you became prime minister, you would get rid of the carbon tax.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Excellent. I'm going to move to a different issue. You mentioned farmers. I grew up, I live in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, which is a little bit different than Toronto and places like that. The gun issue is a big one for a lot of Canadians and a lot of Canadians in the cities to enjoy hunting and that kind of thing. You said that you would get rid of the gun buyback and ban the Trudeau government has brought in. Tell us a little bit about your thoughts there.
Yes, so I was very concerned as a lawyer to see how this OIC initiative came about, because, you know, I think that when we're doing something that's taking away rights like this, that it should go through the legislative process and not a regulatory process, because we have to debate it and we have to make sure that there's no misinformation being put out there. And I detected quite a bit of misinformation. It was presented that this was an assault style weapons ban. And I know from reading the Firearms Act and learning a little bit about this area, that those types of firearms do not exist in Canada. And so what we have end up banning is, you know, the ability for hunters and sports, gaming, sports shooters to be able to utilize these firearms that were one day, they went to bed one day and it was legal, and the next day they woke up as criminals. And so this is very, very disconcerting to me. I see firearms as something that it does need attention in our country, because it does deal with public safety and crime control issues. But I don't think that a ban on law-abiding citizens is the way to go. And I'm very concerned that we've neglected a very important population, and that is the inner city community. And we want to help kids get off crime. We want to help kids make sure that they don't ever touch an illegal firearm. And so I would like to have seen the $2 billion that they're going to invest in buybacks. I would like to see that invest in young people and in, you know, in crime control and in border smuggling initiatives to make sure that our border patrol agents and our law enforcement officers have the sufficient resources to deal with these issues. And also that we go and we create solutions in communities that have been plagued with gun violence. And so I'm very disappointed that the communities that I feel are in most need of this money are not getting them. Instead, we are buying back guns from law-abiding citizens.
So much of this comes down to choices. And right now, when you look at the overall budget, the government is spending tremendous amounts of money. The deficit is soaring. I think it's hard to pin down specifics on how to solve that problem. But in general, how big a priority would it be for you to move back to a balanced budget? And what kind of time frame would you be looking at that? How big a priority is it?
Well, you know, I've said when I was going into politics that, you know, one thing I promised is that I would always, you know, tell the truth is how I saw the situation, and I wouldn't try to sell things to the public. I just wanted to present the facts. And the facts of this situation is that we don't know what the impact, the economic impact of COVID will be, because we didn't have an economic impact assessment. And people say, well, it's an emergency and we didn't have time. But that's what finance departments are for. They are to make these types of determinations about policies that we put in place. And this was not done. So the next person who steps in, the next government, may have some surprises. And so it's very, very difficult to say, when are we going to have a balanced budget? But what I could say is that from the day that I am, you know, elected, that would be my goal, to make sure that the government is run efficiently. And by that, you know, when we look at the last 5 years, there was no reason not to have a surplus. There was no reason not to have a balanced budget, because those were years of prosperity. I believe that deficits should only be acquired during crisis situations where you have no choice. And so now it's going to take a very long-term plan to phase out the deficit. And it's not something that can be done overnight. And I think people need to recognize that. But what we do need to do is we need to change our dynamics in this country. We need to start stimulating businesses, small and medium-sized businesses, upping our production, moving away from being just merely a consumer society to one that produces essential goods that we require in our economy, and cutting a lot of the red tape for businesses so that we can embolden them to start taking chances again and start hiring people and getting our economy back on track.
Ultimately, dealing with the deficit is going to require getting people back to work, getting businesses rolling again. But one thing that holds businesses back, higher taxes. It makes it tougher for them to get going. But we know politicians are going to get a lot of pressure to raise taxes instead of trimming spending. How would you deal with that pressure to raise taxes?
Well, if I wanted to enter politics to raise taxes, I wouldn't have been a conservative. I would have, you know, been with one of the other parties. That's not why I entered politics. I believe in finding efficiencies. I believe in making sure that governments are functioning at the highest level and being transparent and being good stewards of the taxpayers' dollars. And so raising taxes, I think, is not a last option. And I don't think it's an option that we need to exercise. I think what we need to do is we need to kickstart our economy, start building critical infrastructure, start investing in our natural resources, which will generate, from every job in the natural resource sector, it generates 7 splinter jobs in the manufacturing, banking, other sectors. And I think that that's what we need to start doing, investing in our country, reducing our trade deficits with countries like the United States and China, and start producing essential items in Canada, bringing back the supply chains here, which means sometimes giving tax incentives to companies that will, you know, undertake certain initiatives, such as like producing gloves and masks and respirators. And they may not be able to economically do that without assistance from the government. And so that is something that I'm prepared to do in order to bring those critical supply chains back to Canada. And I think it's just very important that we also think about developing our pipelines so that we can have, we could be more reliant on our resources rather than importing oil from abroad.
I think everybody agrees that there's waste in government. We disagree sometimes and debate the amount of waste in government. But I'd like to throw one specific example to you. The federal government is spending about $17 million to renovate the cottage for the Prime Minister at Harrington Lake. We did a little bit of checking around, and you can buy some pretty swanky cottages in cottage country for far, far less than that. We're in a situation where we desperately need to save money. What would you think about selling Harrington Lake?
Historically, I don't know whether or not it is designated as a historical site. So there may be some impediments there in that. And it's not something that I've really looked into. But I do believe that that amount sounds like an extraordinary amount to do some renovations. And so, I would have questions about whether or not there's efficiencies that could be found there in order to reduce those costs. But we also have to acknowledge that, the Prime Minister, that's not his home. You know, he's not going to keep it forever. It's going to be in the legacy of Canada. And so we do want to make sure that it's up to date so that he can entertain dignitaries from around the world and do what he needs to do to execute his job. But my concern is whether or not there's been overspending on that. And if there has been, then we need some accountability for it.
When we talk about getting the economy going again, different sectors, different businesses are going to be lining up for stimulus or corporate welfare or bailouts, whatever the term they use. Bombardier is always ready for more money. If Bombardier or someone like that comes to you for money and you're Prime Minister, what's the answer?
I think corporate welfare is generally a bad idea. And we've seen, lots of confusion around that proposition of corporate bailout. And so, I do also recognize that there have been times where it's been pragmatic to keep businesses afloat. And if there are businesses that we know are going to their closure is going to have a profound detrimental impact on society, then of course we'll sit down and we'll talk to these businesses about making sure that individuals are kept employed. But that does not mean giving huge bonuses to corporate heads. And it also means that these corporate heads who could not keep the businesses afloat on their own initiative, they would have to take serious pay cuts. What I'm against is just this overwhelming notion that governments have an endless pocketbook and that corporations can just tap into that. I think it's a bad precedent to set. I do recognize that there are times where we are going to have to intervene to help businesses keep afloat, but I'm not for the idea of corporate welfare.
When we look at the national stage right now, there's a lot of discontent, particularly in Western Canada. I think the idea of Western separatism is becoming very difficult to ignore. And the issue of equalization has become an important symbol there that really can't be ignored anymore either. If you're Prime Minister, how do you deal with equalization?
Equalization is something that has caused quite a bit of regional discontent. And I think that it has been magnified with the advent of COVID-19. And one of the reasons for that is because while the equalization formula would require a constitutional amendment to modify, there are provisions in the formula that are extremely detrimental, especially in times of crisis, that I don't think were really well contemplated when this provision was enacted. And so, for example, there's a lag time of 3 years in the formula, which means that for COVID in 2020, they're still, places like provinces like Alberta are still paying equalization payments based on 3 years ago. based on calculations of 3 years ago. And so there's no ability to reassess in times of crisis like now. And so the affordability or the unaffordability of that payment becomes magnified because now they're also facing a crisis and there's no means of adjusting it downwards to say, well, you know what, you probably don't have the wealth to make this type of payment because you too are facing a crisis situation. So while, you know, it's a very complicated issue, I do believe that Canadians are fair-minded and that they can understand discrepancies like this and issues like this. And I think that we could all sit down and find resolutions to these problems.
I'm going to take you to transparency and accountability. And we've actually, at the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, we've partnered with an Indigenous activist named Charmaine Stick at the Onion Lake Cree Nation. We've gone to court so that she could force her own leaders to publish the books for the reserve, show how much they're being paid. Unfortunately, the Trudeau government is not enforcing the First Nations Financial Transparency Act. How do you feel about the First Nations Financial Transparency Act? How would you handle it?
Well, I think that it's very important for all governments to be accountable to taxpayers for the monies that they spend. And I don't think that First Nations communities should be any different. The people want to know that their needs are being met and that the dollars are being spent in ways that are going to make meaningful impact on their society. And so we should require First Nations communities to be transparent and to account for how they spend their money, especially to their band members, because I think it talks about, it lets us know exactly what changes need to be made, where the impacts are being felt, and where the loopholes are. And so I think it's very, very important to have that transparency and accountability.
Another question on the concept of transparency and accountability. In 2009, a Liberal MP named Michelle Simpson started publishing her own office expenses and her own personal expenses as a member of parliament on her website. Just started putting them up, no big fanfare, but started disclosing her own expenses. Former Liberal leader Michael Ignatieff put a ton of pressure on her to take down those disclosures, and ultimately she faced a lot of backlash on that. If you're a Conservative leader, and one of the MPs in your caucus starts putting up their expenses on their website for their constituents, how would you handle that situation?
Well, I think it's actually a good idea. If that's what that MP feels would inform her constituents, I think that there's nothing wrong with that. It's the taxpayers' money, and they have a right to know how it's being spent. I think that there's a lot of waste in government. And anything that could shine a light on that waste, I support.
Okay, well, we're almost to the end here, but I wanted to ask one question just about, that illustrates a little bit about who you are. And when I was looking at your biography, it said that you grew up with five older brothers and sisters. And so mm-hmm. I have a question about that. You've been to law school, you've got your doctorate in law, but where did you learn more about winning an argument? In law school or from your older brothers and sisters?
Well, our family dynamics is really peculiar because I'm the youngest of six. And so by the time my parents immigrated to Canada, I was 5 years old and my three other siblings, one was married and two others were off in like either university or private high school. And so they didn't come with us. So it's basically me and my two older brothers that basically grew up in Canada. It was, yeah, being the only girl and having to watch hockey. Hockey came, to me, hockey was on almost every day of the night, which meant I couldn't watch Three's Company. I couldn't watch, you know, the other, you know, shows that I wanted because my brothers basically dominated the television. You know, even the Hockey Night in Canada theme, when I hear it now, I remember, oh my goodness, that means I'm deprived of watching my television shows because my brothers basically, controlled that. So I found, you know, unique ways of getting my own way and, you know, kind of negotiating with them to at least let me watch it during the commercial or let me start with mine until, you know, intermission or So I learned negotiations through that.
It sounds like you were pretty good at it.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me. I really appreciate your time. And is there anything else that you'd like to add?
Well, I just want to say that, you know, everybody knows that we're in a very, very tough race. And the requirements were set so high that the average person, it would have been almost insurmountable to meet it. And I'm very fortunate that I was able to meet it. And I do want to say that I'm really grateful to the Canadian public and to, you know, the conservative membership base for investing in me and believing in me. And I've just tried to be true to my message. I believe that I'm the person that could best beat Justin Trudeau. I know that it's going to take us sticking to our conservative values and also bringing in new Canadians. And I believe that I'm in a unique position to do that. There are many immigrants in the inner cities that have conservative values that we just need to reach them. And I believe that I'm the best person to expand our big blue tent and to take on Justin Trudeau. So I thank you for your support, and I look forward to the end of this race where I can eventually become the leader of this party.
Well, good luck on the campaign trail. Stay safe out there, and thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me here today. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Taxpayers Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show and please share it with your friends. You can find interview information in our show notes and links to all of our past podcast episodes on our website, taxpayer.com.